His Excellency, Deputy Commissioner, other members of the Diplomatic Corps, distinguished guests, friends, colleagues, supporters, fellow members of the panel, ladies and gentlemen, very good morning to you all, and thank you very much for coming. Apologies for the very brief delay in starting. I think we're doing well by our standards. And I bring you warm greetings from the rest of the Europe team. And I'll get into my shorthand for Europe, but I hope by now you have our program. And as you can see from our program, we have a short and what I hope will be an interesting morning for you. Our main event is the presentation on, and the presentation by Dr. Carrico of his report on the impact, his study on the social impact of laws affecting LGBT persons in Guyana. But we're also fortunate to have two other presenters who will provide for us some institutional and legal context of the report. But before we get into the main speakers, I'd be grateful if you could indulge me for a couple of minutes so that I could give you some background to the study itself and to this organization that I've been calling URAP. I think our presence here today is the culmination of a series of events that started perhaps a little more than 3 years ago in 2009. Over the course of a week, the police arrested and charged about seven persons. They were detained over the weekend, released. They were arrested again on a separate occasion and detained for a further period. Eventually, they were brought after a couple of days in custody. They were brought before the magistrate's court. And they weren't charged with any offense about any sort of known crime about, you know, disorderly behavior, loitering or anything. They were charged, the police found this offense called being a man dressed in women's clothing or a woman dressed in man's clothing. And so they were charged as men dressed in women's clothing. So that for conduct or dress, that would be unremarkable in most places of the world. I dare say unremarkable in Guyana even. A number of Guyanese citizens were hauled before the courts and prior to that endured an excruciating period of detention, abominable conditions in the lockups. And then at the end of the day, they were charged with this offense. They, of course, unrepresented, uninitiated, not knowledgeable, they pleaded guilty and were fined after being admonished by the magistrate to give their lives over to Jesus Christ. Now, I would be surprised if right-thinking persons didn't find this whole episode quite outrageous. Quite apart from the fact that Guyana is beset by problems of a far greater import, I think, than the way people dress in public. As fate would have it, however, and this might have passed unnoticed to most people, but as fate would have it, the report of the incident was published in the newspapers, and it was posted by a member of SASOD, Joel, who isn't here today, unfortunately, but it was posted on a listserv. It's titled Caribbean Sexualities, but which deals with issues of this kind of nature, anything dealing with Caribbean sexualities. At the time, myself and a close colleague of mine, Tracy Robinson, at the University of the West Indies, we were actually teaching human rights law when this thing popped up, this notice about this charge. And as I said, as fate would have it, teaching human rights law, but we were also teaching this very sort of topic in human rights law, which was, how do you limit fundamental rights? And I'm taking it as a given that this incident implicated fundamental rights. And Chris mentioned some of this in his report, and we'll get to that eventually. But how do you limit fundamental rights? Because we know no right is absolute. And this incident, I think, and if you permit me, it implicated certain issues when we talk about the limitation of fundamental rights, and I can briefly tell you. First of all, states recognize that fundamental rights can be limited, but only for a justifiable goal. And I'm speaking very loosely, but if you want to limit somebody's freedom, it should be for some greater good, some legitimate state interest. And so the first thing that struck us when we looked at this was, what's the state interest in prohibiting a man from dressing as a woman if he so pleases in public, and vice versa? It's a question that's valid, because that kind of behavior, as I said, unremarkable in most places, strikes to the heart of human sexuality, human dignity, the way people express themselves. It's for the same reason that some men might want to wear earrings, and mine only fell out because it's not here because the back fell out this morning, but or some, you know, so, or some women might dye their hair red or blue, and these are colors I've seen among my students. And so the way you dress, I think it's very much a way about how you want to express yourself, and as I say, strikes to the root of human dignity. And so why a state would want to limit this, I think, must come under strict scrutiny. But there are other things, and I think one of the factors that jumps out at you in something like this is the question of equality. Equality in several grounds, and I mean equality of sex stereotypes. And so, taking the bull by the horns, so to speak, the way we dress, if you identify as a man and you dress as a man, you're fine, and same for a woman. But what if, and this is a recognized, legitimate situation in law, and certainly in international human rights law, if you identify not of a traditional gender, then if the state prohibits you from dressing as you identify, then that very much raises a question of gender discrimination. The other thing that I was talking about was sex stereotypes, requiring people to dress as we think men should dress. Again, an issue of equality. But even more fundamental than that, this law that they were charged on formed part of the vagrancy laws that we as a former colony inherited. And I think if the average person were to look at those laws, they'd be absolutely shocked at what was found there. In a nutshell, what those laws were all about, those laws were aimed at disciplining, regulating, and sort of regulating and ensuring how people behaved in public spaces. And by people, often this meant working class people, and at a certain time, black people. And so, because often with these laws, and I say this with good reason, the same applies to lots of other laws, I think, that deal with petty crimes. And not so petty crimes. Drug offenses come to mind, and I saw this in my years as a magistrate. The person who is working class and who lives his life more or less in the public, so you're in the street corner or your house, you live in situations where you're not behind barricaded or you know, behind high fences. You're more in the public gaze. You're more subject to police regulation. And those vagrancy laws very much targeted both in their concept and more so in their enforcement, working class people. And this is why I say it's very much an issue of equality, equality in the basis of social class. But one of the most striking things about this offense, as I told you, is that it reads being a man dressed in woman's clothing and being a woman dressed in man's clothing. And so our students asked immediately, what does that mean? Because a hallmark of the law is that it should be certain. Because laws carry penalties, in order for you to regulate your conduct, you must know what you can do and you can't do. And so if a law says you mustn't dress in a woman's clothing, or if you're a woman, you mustn't dress in a man's clothing, then there should be clear standards. What is a man's, what is man's clothing? Or what is woman's clothing? And can we then go and rungs up all the women in the audience wearing trousers? Yes? Or jackets? And so, this is not to make you feel unsafe, but it's again to show you the irrational nature of the law, the fact of its indeterminacy. So, let me get a move on. So, that was the backdrop of what happened. At the time, my colleague Tracy and I were, we had just about started forming this organization. It was very in its nascent stage, URAV, and that stands for University of the West Indies Rights Advocacy Group. And URAV had been years in the making. But our vision very much, and this is very much Tracy's vision, I shouldn't say our, Tracy's vision, was based or intended to promote social justice, human rights, equality in the Caribbean through strategic public interest litigation. And one of the things I think that we saw the need for this was that in Caribbean societies where our electoral laws, where our Westminster model constitutions, our constitutional framework more or less was largely modeled on that of the British, a homogenous society. It's quite unsuited to our own realities as we know graphically in Guyana, and what it's produced throughout the Caribbean, not just in Guyana, which is more heterogeneous than most states, what it's produced I think elsewhere is deeply partisan politics, and so that legislative change is very difficult. And so what we saw is that the judiciary is a one route or one avenue for possible change. And so URAP was born out of this insight, and also realizing that URAP could provide services for persons who are on the margins, vulnerable, who are less able perhaps to mount these kinds of challenges. Because in the Caribbean, sadly, there isn't a culture of public interest litigation. And so because we were about that time forming URAP, and our aims, as I said, was to promote litigation, advocacy around human rights, social justice in the Caribbean, our initial project was one in Belize, and again dealing with sexual minorities. We got in touch with SASOD, and through SASOD with the litigants in that case, and eventually what we did was brought a constitutional challenge against this very law that I started telling you about. Constitutional challenge meaning we're saying that this law violates the human rights of Guyanese, and that it can't be, just in a nutshell, it can't be validly justified by a state that has a respect for the rights and freedoms of its citizens. Europe's work generally is in the short term around sexual minorities. You might ask why this focus. That's particularly because, as I said, not only the need for human rights and social justice, but particularly in the area of sexual minorities, it's clear that sexual minorities are among the most marginalized and powerless of people in the Caribbean, and not just Guyana. We do have many human rights concerns, but in addition to every other injustice that sexual minorities face, what they face in addition is great stigma, and perhaps even occupying a position of those of outcasts, you know, pilloried, rejected, so, you know, even more marginalized than everyone else in a minority. But in addition to that, I think, is this question of powerlessness. And as I said, for people who might experiment in different types of dress, very often if you can jump into your car or you live behind high gates, you are never going to get into contact with the police. But if you occupy a more working class level in society, if you're waiting for minibuses at the corner of the road, then is when you are more subject to the gaze of the police, and then is when you're more likely to be targeted by laws of this nature. And this is why URAP thought that intervention on behalf of persons who are unable to defend themselves is something that was quite necessary here. Quite briefly, URAP consists of in the main, a group of public law teachers, and public law meaning constitutional law and human rights, at the University of the West Indies, myself, Tracy Robinson, my colleague, but also a couple others who are based at St. Augustine and the Mona campus of the university. We are also partnered with, in each of the places that we've brought litigation, and speak of the devil, we've also partnered with local lawyers. So my friend and colleague Nigel and Gino Prasad at the Guyana Bar, but also lawyers in Belize. And of course, part of URAP's aim is not only litigation, but research and advocacy and training and education. And so in the course of our work, it's much beyond litigation. It's also partnering with social civil society organizations like SASAD, who has been absolutely helpful to us, and students whose capacity we are constantly trying to develop and build. So finally, part of our work too is not only around litigation but social research. And this brings me to Chris's report. And so the report itself, which Chris will tell you about, was not directly connected, not at all connected to the case, but it's certainly something that we thought about in connection with what's going on here in relation to our work with sexual minorities. A lot of what happens at an academic and even practical level concerns, you know, statements made by academics, lawyers, judges, but very often with little consciousness or knowledge of what happens at the level of the people who live their lives and interact with these laws. And Chris's study, I think, attempts to address this gap. What Chris's study does, I think, is a beginning, admittedly modest, but it's serves a very valuable purpose in terms of the empirical work that it does, and I think the conversation that it will start about these issues. So that brings me to our proceedings today. As you see, we do have Chris will give you his presentation on the report. But before that, we are fortunate to have two members who will give you, on our panel, who will give you a little more context than I have. Juliet Bynoe Sutherland from CARICOM and Eulalie Burnham, who is a barrister in London. But for